is an expert on MMT? I'm trying to remember. I think she might be.
I am unaware. My guys would be like Rohan Gray and Warren Mosler, obviously, and Randall Ray. Those are the main three guys that I would listen to. But
all right, we will look into it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You have a great rest of your day.
You too. There is Roylin with a beautiful phone call. Let's go to Pablo from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I've never been to New Mexico, Pablo.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, great. I'm not sure I really have a question. It's more a while back you had asked why we should keep on bringing up about the deaths of like right-wing conservatives. And it's sort of touching on that.
Wait, hold on a second. I asked, why should we bring up the deaths of conservatives?
Yes, in regards to COVID deaths.
Okay.
Pretty much like when all these...
Let me see if I can understand. So you're saying sometimes an anti-vaccine right-winger gets COVID and dies. And,
yes,
and I said part of the reason to bring it up is that it exposes the incredible hypocrisy and also futility of their perspective when they confidently say no one needs to be vaccinated and then they die. And hopefully it'll encourage other people to get themselves vaccinated. Is that more or less what you're talking about?
Yeah, more or less. And the reason why I think is... as you said, you have to, they're confronted with, oh, well, you know, this, everybody was saying, people on the right, conservatives were saying, oh, you don't need a vaccine. Look, you'll be fine. You don't have to wear a mask, especially with the mask, being a mandate, not being required on planes. It does confront them with their own, sort of beliefs. There's somebody that Joe Rogan interviewed on his podcast, Megan Phelps Rogers, who is
Megan
actually...
Phelps Roper.
Roper, yes.
Yeah, I've interviewed her as well.
Okay. I hadn't seen that one. I was actually curious about that. But yes, and you know, she mentioned how exactly being part of the Westboro Baptist Church, there's somebody that kept on confronting her about all these ideas that she had. And it was a lot harder for her to, once she was politely confronted with all these different ideas, she sort of had to come to grips with that. A lot of it didn't make sense to herself.
Yes. Absolutely well said. Thank you, Pablo.
All right. Thank you, David.
All right. Yes. Let's confront people politely when they have incorrect ideas. Let's take a very quick break. We are going to take more calls in a moment. So don't hang up if you're hanging on to talk to me. Let's go back to the phones via Discord at davidpakman.com/discord. Let's go next to Eric from Cancun. Eric, welcome back. Eric from Cancun, you're on the air if you can get your audio working. And last chance for Eric from Cancun, plagued with corrosive technical difficulties. All right. No Eric from Cancun today. Not a problem. Let's go next to Cody from San Diego. How is San Diego? I was there not long ago. Love the weather. Great restaurants.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
It's pretty great down here in San Diego, you know.
Good.
pretty good weather. I didn't, I kind of had just a scenario I wanted to comment on. It's kind of like just accepting, just being a doomer and accepting that Republicans very well may win in 2022 and looking forward to 2024 if likely scenarios keep on happening and they win then as well. What do you think the climate looks like? I mean, back in 2016, kind of the narrative around that I was hearing back then was whether Trump or Hillary wins, it's kind of like not necessarily going to affect the daily lives of the middle class. Like we kind of see some of the repercussions now. Do you think it's going to be like very like incremental repercussions type of thing, or is it going to be kind of drastic swing changes that we'll see take place right away if a scenario like that would happen? Just wanted to
I
get
don't
your
know that
thoughts.
I understand you. You're saying if Republicans take the House and Senate in the midterms, how radical will the change be? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in the midterms, and then also if that compounds into them taking the White House in 2024.
2024 is too far away to say because
Okay.
that's a few layers away.
Fair.
Here's the things that will change very quickly if Republicans take the House and Senate in November. First of all, no bills are getting passed. So, Biden did infrastructure. He did a COVID stimulus bill. There's a number of different bills that were passed. Nothing is going to get done. Nothing. It just there will be nothing done for 2 years, except, if there is the most dire emergency where Congress absolutely has to do something, they're going to do it. But it will basically be 2 years of obstructing Joe Biden in an even more overt way than is being done right now. Number two. Yes, probably there will be House investigations into Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, and they may even impeach him, and they will very quickly make the United States a joke again, the way it was under Donald Trump. So I think that, when we say, well, the middle class won't really be directly affected. Well, I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But the reputation of the United States will very quickly go into the toilet again as a laughing stock. So it remains to be seen how quickly they will do these things, but they will do them. And unfortunately, I do think they're going to win in the fall.
Yeah, that's the scenario I see as well.
Yeah.
But just to kind of compound on your point, do you think what do you think the tangible I guess repercussions of a Joe Biden impeachment would be?
Well, I don't think it would remove him. I think it would just be, remember, the impeachment is what the House does, and then the Senate would either convict or acquit. I don't think that he would get convicted because he didn't do anything wrong. And so that's a factor. Even with Republicans having a slight majority in the Senate, I don't think that Joe Biden gets convicted on impeachment. I think it will just become a charade, it will become a distraction, and it will just build the humiliation of the United States globally.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your comments. Thanks,
All right,
David.
Cody from San Diego, thank you. Keep enjoying the good weather there. Let's go next to let's go to Itai from Copenhagen, Denmark.
Hi, David. It's good to be on.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, what are the odds that given the Democratic presidential candidate in 2024 wins the Electoral College and the Republican candidate refuses to concede that the Republican-controlled Congress will overturn the election and make said Republican candidate the next president of the US?
So that's a really good question. So let me restate the scenario so people understand it. Some Democratic candidate wins the 2024 presidential election. Maybe it's Biden, maybe it's someone else. They win. They get more electoral votes. They are supposed to be the next president. However, Republicans, let's imagine, control both the House and the Senate. Could they successfully prevent the winner from becoming the president of the United States? My instinct, Itai, is to say no, it wouldn't happen. They don't really have the power. They tried to take that power. Some of them did in 2020. They don't really have the power. So there's no way in hell that they prevent the Democratic winner from becoming the president. That's my instinct. But then I think about, well, hold on a second. Even in 2020, they weren't close, but they were close to making it tough. And so if they were in full control, what would happen? And then I start to get a little bit scared.
Let's hope the former case is true.
Let's.
I also wanted to ask you, what topic would you like to be taught in public school that would make the American public more politically aware and engaged?
Critical thinking and media literacy.
Ah, that's good.
Yeah.
I would have picked a course on political ideologies so people at least know what the different terms actually mean.
Yeah. I see that as only really being useful if everybody already is educated in critical thinking and media literacy. I see those as prior steps to jumping into political ideology, but I don't disagree with you.
I see. I also wanted to suggest that you should cover less the hate mail that you get, be it chats and from voicemails. It's because we already know that you are getting it. It's a given. I would suggest, unless it's constructive criticism, to just ignore it because it's not worth your time.
So listen, I understand that. We do on Fridays in the last segment, we do 10 minutes of emails, and usually there's like two that are negative. So it's like 10 minutes on one show a week, and it's only one or two of those minutes. So I understand the opinion. It's a really small part of what we do.
Oh, I see. That was me. Here in Denmark, just so your audience knows, the COVID pandemic is soon over. There are still some cases, but we don't wear masks or anything.
Okay, yeah, there's really no masks in the U.S. either. Hey, real quick, can you very slowly pronounce Copenhagen the way you do in Denmark? Because I struggle to understand how you guys pronounce it. Can you say it once slowly for me?
In Danish or English?
In Danish.
Copenhagen. It's because the U is a sound that doesn't exist in English.
Okay, and say it one more time slowly for me.
Copenhagen.
Okay. Wow. So the G really disappears.
It does.
It does.
It's more of a V sound.
Got it.
Danish.
All right. Very good. Thank you. I appreciate the call.
Thank you, David. And have a nice day.
You too. There's Itai from Copenhagen is the way I say it. Okay. Let's go next. Where are we going next? It's hard to know, because the phone calls are so widespread. Let's try going to Southcat. Southcat, you're on the air.
Oh,
Southcat.
Oh my goodness! Hello, David.
Oh, are you Scottish?
No, Australian.
Oh, Australian. Yes. Oh, okay. Sorry, I misheard your accent initially. Welcome.
Thank you so much. A lot of people probably expect me to sound like Crocodile Dundee with a shrimp on the Barbie, but no. Thanks for taking my call. I was having a chat to somebody recently about. Well, his thoughts were that the Build Back Better plan had an effect on inflation, like a market of what, from what I believe, quite a bit of an effect on inflation. And I thought, I didn't necessarily agree with that, but what are your thoughts if you...
No, I don't think so. Inflation inflation predates the infrastructure package passed by Joe Biden, and it also is global, including, you know, affecting countries that have nothing to do with American infrastructure spending. So I've seen no evidence that that is the case.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. Hopefully he might be listening. And just another thing, I just wanted to say I really appreciate the forensic nature in which you comment on words, the rhetoric that people in the media, whoever they are, over a broad spectrum, it's really important. Words matter, you know.
I appreciate that very much.
You're really good at it.
So, Southcat, thank you. Listen, is it like 1:30 in the morning in Australia right now? What time is it there?
It's 2:40. I'm doing bit of work.
It's the middle of the night. Is it the middle of the night?
Yeah, it's actually, it is. No, 2:40 a.m.
Right.
Yeah. Bit of a night owl when I have to get a lot of work done. So, and one more thing. Just one quickly. I also appreciate you mentioning the situation with healthcare, especially with, I saw that, I think it's Kentucky, have banned abortion.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's Kentucky. This is disturbing. I really feel bad about it. So yeah. Hopefully things will get better. Yeah.
All right, Southcat, you've said it all. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thank you. There is Southcat from Australia, the middle of the night, the witching hour, as some might call it. All right, let's go to Isaiah from Arkansas. Isaiah, welcome back to the show.
Hey, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, so I just have a little question that I'll have to explain a little bit, but the question is, do you think that it's actually possible for politicians to represent the will of the people? And kind of what I mean by that is, as just one example, in Ireland right now, the same poll, you have a majority of people that say, we want to join NATO.
Yep.
And in the same poll, same group, a majority of people oppose abandoning neutrality. So
right.
A fundamentally contradictory idea.
Yeah. So your question is actually a different one. This is interesting. You're asking the question as, can politicians really represent their constituents? But the real question is, can politicians actually know what their constituents want? That's fundamentally the question
asking. That's kind of what I meant. Like,
yeah.
Let's say I'm running for office and I'm not. I'm way too young for that.
Sure.
But, you know, I, you know, am not particularly informed about an issue, trying to learn, trying to figure out, like, hey, what do the people in my state want?
Right.
When you have contradictory ideas.
I think that this is a solvable problem. Now, I understand how if you join NATO, you're no longer neutral. So how could you want both to be neutral and to join NATO? That's a really specific example. Let me argue that for the most important domestic issues, it's much easier to understand what your constituents want. And so I do think that that's a solvable problem. But I agree that with something like foreign policy, particularly because a lot of people don't know what's going on, it can be hard to ascertain what people actually want you to do. That's fair. But I think with the bulk of issues, we can get pretty good data about what people want.
Yeah. Well, like, to tie it to like a domestic issue, which I was trying to stay away from, but like with universal health care,
right,
a majority of Americans polled say they support universal health care, which I do as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a majority of Americans also oppose paying for health care through taxes.
Right. Yeah, so that's a conflict. And that one is very complex, because you can even ask that second question about taxes in different ways and get dramatically different answers. So it's not even as it's actually even more complicated than you're pointing out. But point taken, you're raising an important issue.
Yeah. And I have two little side things. One, I'm actually wanted your opinion on this, going to Florence and Rome in Italy in a few weeks.
Okay.
For a class of mine. I was wondering if you have, we'll kind of be going all around the city. Have you been to either of those two cities, and are there special food items you would encourage me to try?
Well, I've never been to Florence, but I have been to Rome. I mean, honestly, just stay away from the tourist traps. If they have like multicolored menus in eight languages and someone suggesting you eat there, don't go there. But there's so many great, great places. There's one place that's basically known for cod fritters in Rome. I forget the name of it. I think it's like Filetto di Bacalao or something like that. I would absolutely go there. There's a place called Macaroni. It's kind of like sounds like the word macaroni in English. And it's also another great little spot. I mean, it's just stay away from the tourist traps. You really can't go wrong in Rome.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. And before you let me go, I just want to say I really, really appreciate you among all the leftist broader, however you define yourself, political punditry, and just how honest you've been with specifically things in regards to Ukraine.
Mm.
I've been very, very disillusioned with a lot of the left and a lot of creators I formerly respected, in retrospect, have had to go look back at their content, and it's really disillusioned me with a lot of stuff. So I really appreciate your coverage of it and your honesty.
All right, Isaiah, I appreciate the compliments. I am going to let you go and hope to hear from you again soon, and enjoy Italy. That's going to do it for today. We will take calls again. We'll take a quick break and be right back. My friends, it is time for the Friday mailbag. You can email info@davidpakman.com if you have something you'd like to say. Sometimes tweets or YouTube comments or Instagram comments may be included as well. Don't abuse info@davidpakman.com. It's not good for you and it's not good for me either. Let's just jump in with the first message. This one is from Charles. Charles is writing about the Hunter Biden laptop. And Charles says, well, since the laptop has been deemed real, why don't you look into it and then say it's not a big deal? I almost feel bad for the Cuckman. I think that's me. He goes through his whole life thinking he is intellectually capable. David Pakman is the Cuckman. He makes his wife's boyfriend a Sammy after he slays her and thanks her for the opportunity to watch. Him and Will Smith should hand out. They can be a good support system for each other. Both are cucks. Both of their wives have public relations with others. This is the level of people who want to decide who else is intellectually capable. Now, as we've said before, we've talked about the Hunter Biden laptop story. The story is filled with misinformation and also has nothing to do with Joe Biden. So to the extent that the story is a media story, we've talked about it, but that's about as far as I'm interested in going with the Hunter Biden laptop. Polar wrote in and said, when most people look at David Pakman, they just see a dude. When conservatives look at David Pakman, they somehow detect foreign-born, Jewish, East Coast urban dweller, and most offensively of all, not at all an outrage-crazed maniac. Yeah, I'll talk with other hosts of shows like mine, and we'll talk about kind of like the tone and tenor of the hate mail and the antagonistic comments that we get. And everybody else says to me, they are regularly shocked by the focus on Judaism in the messages that I get. It'd be interesting to talk. Sam Cedar, I don't want to speak out of turn, but Sam has at least suggested that he doesn't get nearly as much anti-Semitic stuff as I do, even though Sam is Jewish. And I don't know what that's about. But in speaking with like Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks, we've talked about it also. You know, he gets stuff based on him being, quote, Muslim or Turkish. And I get a lot of anti-Semitic stuff and a lot of go back to Mexico, go back to Venezuela stuff, even though I'm from Argentina. That's another thing. And yeah, it's not only about stereotypes. It's also about ignorance as to whom do those stereotypes even apply. Like, I'm from Argentina. Why would I go back to Venezuela? I've never even been there. Next message is from Rhonda. Rhonda says, yeah, Dave, speaking of which, yeah, David, you do look like maybe you are Jewish. I know several Latins that are fair skinned and look Jewish. Well, thank you, Rhonda, for defending that I could be both Hispanic and Jewish. No, a lot of people don't know that Argentina is a very white country. I'm not giving my opinion of whether that's good or bad. You know, there's lots of white supremacists who ended up Nazi types who ended up in Argentina after World War II, and a lot of Jewish refugees who ended up in Argentina. I'm just saying there's a lot of what we would consider white people in Argentina. That's a fact, not an opinion. But thank you, Rhonda. All right. Into some more substantive stuff. John says, David, have you thought about adding a co-host to your show? Don't get me wrong. I love your show and enjoy listening to it just like it is. And I also like the guest hosts when you're on vacation, like Farron and Jesse. But I like the Young Turks, too, because it's fun listening to multiple hosts bouncing ideas and opinions off each other on the topic being discussed. Just an idea. So here's the thing with this. You can always change your show to be more like a different show. And at one point in the past, we had not really co-hosts, but we would sometimes have, you know, like producers would weigh in or whatever. Not every show can be the same. So this show doesn't have co-hosts, and that's what this show is. If people only like shows with co-hosts, those shows exist. But my view is not every show has to be the same. So this show is, it's just me giving my thoughts, and we have callers and we have other things. There are other shows with co-hosts and no audience participation. There are also shows that do a little bit of both. Every show is different. There's a show out there for everyone, but this is how our show is set up for the time being. Nicholas wrote in about the RNC withdrawing from the Commission on Presidential Debate, something we talked about previously, as well as earlier this week. Nicholas said, hear me out. Have a debate that's just a Democrat and a third party. Imagine if you had Biden or some Democrat and Justin Amash debating and just left Republicans out of it. The RNC would be like, no, you weren't supposed to do that. And it would be amazing. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. And this even came up on our bonus show discussion earlier this week about Republicans seemingly bailing on presidential debates. The idea of Republicans is to delegitimize or delegitimate, the presidential debates by saying they are biased and the Commission on Presidential Debates is partisan and we're just getting out. And they're imagining, of course, that that would leave only the Democratic nominee and that there would just be no debates whatsoever. It is true that if you had, you know, I've always said I want third parties to have more of a presence in American politics. If you had a stronger third party candidate or multiple candidates and the commission organized legitimate debates where you had the Democratic nominee as well as those third party candidates, it might make the RNC lose their mind. That's absolutely true. The risk, of course, is that because there's no Republican in the presidential debates, very few Republicans even watch it. You have a Democrat with a couple of third party candidates, and all it serves to do is to siphon off some voters from the Democratic candidate to those third party candidates. So I think it is not a strategy without risk. It would absolutely trigger Republicans to be left out, for sure. It might be to their benefit. And so I think it has to be thought through very carefully. Harb wrote in with an idea for a different 5-day work week. Now, we've been talking a lot about the 4-day work week. The 4-day work week, the idea is you have a 4-day work week and a 3-day weekend. Every week, you do a little bit of adjustment of hours, you do a little bit of adjustment of expectations, and you sort of like more or less get the same amount of work done in information type jobs, knowledge jobs. This doesn't work when it's about a retail store being open, as you would in a 5-day work week. Harb has a different idea, which is a 5-day work week, which is 3 days on, 2 days off. So the weekends move. And the idea would be you do 3 10-hour days and then you get 2 days off. And then you get another 3 10-hour days and then you get 2 days off. So the 2 days off shift throughout the week. It's a little complicated, but the idea is that you end up working a little more each year, but you also have more days off each year. And this will allow people to have both weekdays off and weekends off. I think it's really interesting and there's a lot of sense in it. And I've heard proposals like this before. The difficulty is it does become a nightmare for childcare. It becomes a nightmare for a lot of different things where you have to know, okay, if I'm making a doctor's appointment for 6 months in advance, is this the week where I have Wednesday and Thursday off? Or is this the week where I have Saturday and Sunday off? So there's a lot of complexities to it. That's not a reason not to do it, but it seems very difficult to imagine that the working world at large is going to be interested in such a proposal. But I find all of these things super interesting. Cher wrote in about Dr. Phil. Now, here I have to say I misspoke on the show last week. Okay. Cher wrote in and said, hey, David, it is incorrect to say Dr. Phil isn't a real doctor. Well, first of all, I didn't say that. Okay, but I'm going to read the email as is, and then I'll issue my correction. It's incorrect that Dr. Phil isn't a real doctor. He has a BA in psychology. He got his master's in experimental psychology and a PhD in clinical psychology at North Texas State University. He stopped renewing his license in 2006. He is a retired doctor of psychology. So I misremembered. Dr. Phil is a psychologist. He is not a medical doctor, and he does not have an active license. I wrongly said he was not a psychologist. I was wrong when I said that. The segment had nothing to do with Dr. Phil, fortunately. It was just sort of like an aside, but I misspoke. He has not renewed his license. He doesn't have an active license. Jose wrote in about Rumble saying, "Hey, David, I wanted updates on why you haven't uploaded videos to Rumble recently. I think it's good to try and grow an audience where left-wing content is almost non-existent." Yeah, we continue putting up our content on Rumble, which is the right-wing video platform. There was about a 10-day period where Rumble wasn't publishing our videos. There was some kind of glitch. We didn't stop. They fixed it. Now, I don't know how much longer the Rumble experiment is going to go on. We only have like 1,000 subscribers there after a couple months. It doesn't seem there's a big appetite for left-wing content on Rumble. It doesn't really hurt us in any way to leave the content up, but we're thinking about, okay, we tried it and there's not much of an appetite. Maybe we'll leave the content up. Maybe we won't. Lastly today, Catherine wrote in about My Pillow. Catherine says, "Did you see the Consumer Reports ratings for My Pillow? The quality is mediocre at best. I think Consumer Reports really tried to be nice about it, but they are paid truth tellers. My mother bought a few about 7 years ago. She was addicted to TV sales pitches, and it was the worst pillow I ever tried to sleep on. The lumpiness was annoying and uncomfortable. It just didn't work for me. It was nothing more than chopped up foam. Personally, I love a good quality down pillow." Yeah, so two things. One, I have never owned any MyPillow products, but many of you have written in. Most of you say that they're not good. Every once in a while, I'll get an email from someone who says, "Guys, I hate Mike Lindell as much as anybody. He's a loon, but the pillows are good." So conflicting reports, generally negative. I have stopped talking about down pillows on my show because every time I say I like a good down pillow, people write in and say, "David, those are cruel. The goose feathers and the duck feathers, etc." So, Catherine, it's great that you're enjoying a down pillow. I no longer talk about my pillows because it's become too contentious with my own audience. All right, you can write in info@davidpakman.com. Send me your questions, comments, etc. We have a great bonus show coming up for you today. Every day, we do an extra show for our members. Sign up at joinpakman.com. You'll get instant access to the bonus show, and you can now gift memberships. We have a backlog of about 700 people who want a membership but can't afford one. You can check the box that says this is a gift, and we will give your membership to someone.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, news media coverage of taxes falls broadly into two camps. There are, especially in April, lots of news you can use type stories, like NBC's Today show warning viewers to be mindful of typos and not to be lazy about filing for extensions. Or NBC Nightly News noting that if you filed by mail, you might wait 5 to 8 months for your return due to backlogs at the IRS. Taxes, in other words, as in, oh, well, what are you going to do sort of thing that all of us have to deal with. Then there are other disconnected stories about tax policy. Who pays, how much, and why? We've talked about that a fair amount on this show, and we're going to revisit two of those conversations today. Last April, we spoke with Emory College law professor and author Dorothy A. Brown about how, though you can scour tax policy and find no mention of race, our tax system still affects Black people very differently in ways most conversation obscures. And in February of 2019, we spoke with economist Dean Baker about why the idea of raising taxes on the super wealthy makes sense to many mainstream economists and to the general public, but still faces a perennial headwind in corporate media. Two revelatory conversations about tax policy this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In the United States today, the median white family, not average, but median, half above, half below, has a net worth, that means wealth or assets minus debts or liabilities, 8 times that of the median Black family. That's the same gap as 40 years ago, despite gains that Black people have made in income and education and all of the things that you do to accrue wealth. So what's going on and what does it have to do with our system of taxation? In April of 2021, we spoke with Dorothy A. Brown. She's Asa Griggs Candler Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law and author of the book The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. I asked her, first of all, to address the fact that although Black people are underpaid generally and shuttled into work sectors that are underpaid, employment income, how much money comes in, is different from tax policy, though they are related.
That's right. So, you know, how much income we have helps inform how much we owe in taxes. But what my research showed is when Black and white Americans engage in the same activity, whether it's work, whether it's owning a home, whether it's getting married, whether it's paying for college, tax policies subsidize the way white Americans engage in the activity while disadvantaging the way Black Americans engage in the activity.
Well, so let's just get into that a little more. What are some of the ways that that works, that that happens?
Well, we can start with what you talked about, which jobs. So we know that there's occupational segregation, right? Some jobs are disproportionately filled by white Americans, and other jobs are disproportionately filled by Black Americans. But there are tax subsidies associated with jobs. Think employer-provided retirement accounts. Any money that the employer puts in a retirement account, any money you put in a retirement account, is not taxed today, even though it's wage income. It will be taxed later when you retire and withdraw the amount. And presumably in 20, 30, 40 years when you retire, you won't be working, and the amount of income taxes you pay on that retirement amount will be less,
right?
If you were to take the money today, add it to your other wage income, you'd be paying higher taxes. So it's a big tax break. Well, what we know are jobs that are disproportionately held by white Americans are more likely to come with retirement benefits. But even when a Black American is fortunate enough to get such a job, we are less likely to participate and contribute to that benefit. And if we are able to participate to that retirement account, we're more likely to withdraw an amount early that's subject to a tax penalty. So how does this happen? Research shows Black college graduates are more likely to send money to their parents or grandparents to help them pay for necessities, whereas white college graduates are more likely to receive money from their parents and grandparents that could help them with a down payment for a home, pay for K-12 private school for their children, so that even if, miraculously, we were to find a white American and a Black American making the same amount, we know that doesn't happen, right, because of race discrimination in the labor market. But even if we find that, the Black worker, because their parents and grandparents suffered under Jim Crow, is going to be more likely to have less after-tax dollars because they're going to send some money home.
Right. You know, Jeremy Greer from the Corporation for Enterprise Development told me, income helps you get by, but wealth helps you get ahead and allows you to think about the future. And it's so critical. And if you don't have to think of it that way, well, then you don't think of it that way, you know?
That's right.
You know, and that's so, okay, well, okay, that's just the law is what we would hear, you know? And yet we see corporations write tax law favorable to themselves. We see Congress carve out exceptions or offer rebates for specific individual companies. Like, it looks like sausage is being made. And yet we're somehow disinclined to think that that corruption and cronyism might include systemic racism.
Absolutely. And part of the problem is the IRS doesn't collect or publish statistics based on race. So people can walk around saying tax law is colorblind because when you go to the IRS statistics, it has nothing up there dealing with race. In fact, I've been writing in this area for a couple of decades, and the typical white tax law professor ignores what I say or pushes back or marginalizes what I say because their response is, there's nothing in the code about race. There's nothing in tax law about race, which ignores the disparate impact based on race. I mean, we've seen this in Georgia with voting rights. There's nothing in the Republican passed legislation that's going to make it harder for black people to vote that says, black people, we want it to be harder for you to vote.
Right.
But we all know that's going to be the impact and that that was the intent behind the law. So the notion that you have to have a law say we discriminate against black people before we can find the law actually discriminates against black people defies logic and history.
And, you know, everyone, and everyone, I use the term loosely, but people agree that black people are behind, are disadvantaged, whatever their explanation for that is. Yes. But then when it comes time to intervene to allow, not help, but allow to stop preventing black people getting ahead, it becomes a whole different conversation that's about the intervention and its unfairness. And I just wanted to ask you, why have previous policy responses failed to adequately address the wealth gap, and then what sort of responses could?
So, you know, we have a lot of research on the wealth gap, and we have proposals for how to address it. But part of the problem is you have the left and the right seeing different causes of it. Mm-hmm. And I have quarrels with both. The left sees this mainly as a function of historical discrimination that it's brought into the 21st century. The right sees it as bad behavior on the part of black Americans, mm-hmm. right? So the left gets it wrong in this instance. Yes, it was historical discrimination, but the reason why wealth doesn't work the same way for white Americans as black Americans today is because of choices white people make. So let's take homeownership. Most white homeowners live in neighborhoods with very few black Americans. That's how they like it. That's what the research shows. So progressive whites who live in neighborhoods with virtually no black neighbors are part of why homeownership builds more wealth for white Americans than black Americans. Because black Americans typically live in racially diverse or all black neighborhoods, and the homes are not valued as greatly as the exact same home in an all-white neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Why? Because white prospective home buyers don't want to live in those neighborhoods, so they're not valued as high. So that's not historical discrimination. That's 21st century today discrimination by white homeowners.
Right.
On the other side, we have the right that says, well, black people just need to act more like white people. We need to get married. We need to buy homes. I've already told you why buying a home isn't the ticket to wealth for black Americans the way it is white Americans, but getting married. My research shows that when white people get married, they're more likely to get a tax cut. How? Because the tax law favors married couples with one single wage earner. One person who works in the paid labor market, the other person who works at home. That couple gets a tax cut. Couples like my parents, my mother was a nurse, my father was a plumber, they made roughly equal amounts. They don't get a tax cut. And for decades, they paid higher taxes. So you have conservatives saying, black people, you just need to get married. And my research shows, well, when we do, we don't get a tax cut.
Right. Right.
So part of the road to a solution is really understanding the problem. And one of the key pieces that I make in my book is the system of America for building wealth is designed for white wealth. It's designed for how white Americans engage in their activities, whether it's marriage or buying a home, in a way that black Americans simply cannot replicate. And until we come to terms with our racist wealth building system, no solution is going to fix it.
Well, let me ask you, finally, you've been working on this for a while, and you've seen the interest in the topic, or even the belief that it is a topic, shift.
Yeah.
After George Floyd's murder, you say in this Bloomberg Businessweek piece from March, suddenly people wanted to talk about race and tax. I don't want you to burn any bridges with reporters, but I am curious, when you talk to media, where do you have to start? Do you find people disbelieving? Are they ready to see that this is real? And it doesn't have to be media, but just the general public. Do you feel like the moment's right to push this forward?
I do. And I will say this. Post George Floyd, the reporters who have called me have been terrific and have been in a listening mode. They have not been in an argumentative mode. Mm-hmm. I will say pre-George Floyd, white reporters that I've talked to, that I've tried to talk about race, have been very dismissive. And they're different people. Those people did not come back to me post-George Floyd, right?
Okay.
The people who came to me were all new white reporters who I hadn't talked to before, who actually saw the moment and wanted to get better informed. So that's kind of heartening, to be honest with you. I haven't had the pushback. And I will say over the years, the audiences that gave me the most comfort were the general public audiences.
Mm-hmm.
They were hungry for what I had to say and curious and were listening and attentive. It was the white academics who didn't want to hear anything I had to say. So the general public has always been an encouragement for me in doing this work.
We've been speaking with Dorothy Brown, Asa Griggs Candler Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law. The book is The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. It's out now from Crown. Thank you so much, Dorothy Brown, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dorothy A. Brown speaking with Counterspin in April of 2021. One in three GoFundMe campaigns in this country are for medical expenses, and one in five households have zero or negative wealth. And this is the same society in which there are also some people who can't remember how many houses they own. Inequality is a life or death issue, which makes it especially worrying that some people with media megaphones seem proudly ignorant of the basic mechanisms by which resources are distributed. And some of those myths and misunderstandings were thrown into relief in early 2019 when we saw a rather bold, for recent times, conversation about progressive taxation, occasioned by proposals from New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others. We spoke with Dean Baker, co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I asked him, first of all, to talk a bit about top marginal tax rates and increased taxes on extreme wealth in the wake of a proposal from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggesting the idea of a top marginal tax rate of 70%, as well as wealth tax proposals from Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, which had been received by media as though they were ideas from Mars.
The reaction to both proposals has been fascinating, both the public reaction, where there's clearly been a lot of support. People are saying, yeah, you have a lot of real rich people. Why shouldn't they pay more in taxes? But more so from the media and, you know, from some establishment politicians. So the reaction is, oh, here's flaky Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, where she'd get off 70%. And in fact, that's a number that many of the world's most prominent tax economists have said. This is the maximum tax rate. You could, maximum tax rate in the sense, maximum amount of revenue. And there was an article, widely read article, by Peter Diamond, who's a professor at MIT, and Manuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, both very, very prominent. Diamond won Nobel Prize, Saez, John Bates Clark Award, two of the most prestigious awards you can get in the profession. So these are people in very high standing. And they came up with that number. You know, and there were all sorts of qualifications and reservations, but in any case, they didn't think it was ridiculous. So when you have a new member of Congress propose that, well, the media jumped on that like, oh, she's just being flaky. And in fact, it's a very reasonable thing to put on the table, whether that's the right rate. You know, of course, you could debate that, but it certainly was not a ridiculous proposal. And, you know, again, Paul Krugman had a very nice piece where he's contrasting that with the Republican proposals to cut taxes on the rich, where they were saying that they would pay for themselves, which was ridiculous, but that was treated like these are serious people. So it's been fascinating that there's been such a rush to dismiss these as kind of far-out proposals by radical leftists when they're reasonable proposals, which, again, is not to say that they're necessarily the best policy, but they're certainly reasonable proposals to put on the table and to be debated.
Well, we read that Michael Dell, who has $30 billion or so at the World Economic Forum, apparently said, name a country where that's worked ever, the 70% top marginal rate. Missing something, you could say.
Yeah, of course, the one of his co-panelists said the United States, because that was, in fact, the rate in the United States until Ronald Reagan lowered it with his tax cuts in 1981. And if we go back a little further, it was 90% in the Eisenhower days. Kennedy had lowered it to 70%. So, again, one could argue whether these are the best rates, but to treat this as a crazy idea out of, you know, far left field is just wrong. And, you know, some of the back and forth, because I was on Twitter with Dell and, you know, there were others involved, obviously. And what I find most striking here, Dell's kind of a poster child here, because what is Dell's expertise in this area? He's very rich, no doubt about that, but he obviously knows nothing about tax rates. I mean, again, we could disagree 70% the right rate, but to act like that's just impossible, we're going to see our economy collapse, that's nuts. He knows nothing about it. He just has $30 billion, so therefore he thinks he's qualified to talk about it.
Well, it's good, I think, that we're talking about taxing extremely high incomes and wealth for all kinds of reasons. The LA Times' Michael Hiltzik was saying, you know, it helps move us away from this notion that wealth is self-made, you know, that these folks owe nothing to society, and it disrupts the fallacy of trickle-down. But having said that, it does take the form of a give-back. You know, you've got an absurd amount of money, so you should throw some back in the pot because that's the socially decent thing to do. You suggest in this recent piece for Truthout that while that is not wrong, it's not getting to the crux, the bigger source of the rise in inequality.
Yeah, so the point I made in that piece, and really I've made in much of my writings over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, is that the distribution of income is not something that just happens. It depends on how we structure the economy. And I would say the economy is pretty much infinitely malleable. We could structure it all sorts of different ways. And my favorite example here, just because it's so blatant, is I like to say, how rich would Bill Gates be if he didn't have copyright or patent monopolies on Windows software? So if anyone in the world could just start producing, mass producing computers and copy in Windows and all the other Microsoft software, and they don't even have to send them a thank you note. Well, needless to say, he would not be one of the richest people in the world. He wouldn't have $100 billion. I'm sure he'd do fine. But, you know, the fact that someone like Bill Gates could become incredibly wealthy was because of how we designed that market. And it's pretty much the same story everywhere you look. Finance, where would all these Goldman Sachs guys be if we didn't have the bailout in 08 and we just let the market run its course? I mean, there's many other ways we subsidize finance as well. Corporate CEOs, they were always well paid. But if you go back to the pay standards of the 60s and 70s, they'd be getting $2 or $3 million a year, not $30 and $40 million. So we structure rules that allow people to get incredibly wealthy. And I really prefer that to be the focus, both because as a practical matter, it's much harder to get the money back once they have it. I mean, there's all sorts of practical issues that people have rightly raised. You know, when Elizabeth Warren says, let's tax the wealth, well, they're not just going to hand it over to you. It's going to be hard to do. It doesn't say it's not something we might want to do, but it's going to be hard. And secondly, the political issue. If we act as though, well, you know, Bill Gates got that fair and square, we shouldn't take any of it back. If you go, well, we could have kind of structured it differently, and then Bill Gates won't have it, and then we don't even have to have this discussion.
I wonder, do you think it's a trap to talk about these things in terms of revenue, in terms of how much money it would bring to the economy? I read a piece by Vanessa Williamson from Brookings where she said that taxes on the very wealthy should be judged by their societal impact and not simply by their revenues, that it has to do with the fact that just having some people be so wildly wealthy is incompatible with democracy. And so we shouldn't get too hung up on how much money it would give to the economy to institute some of these changes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very important point. And I remember some years ago, there was a piece on the estate tax that was done by Alicia Minnell, who's now at Boston College. And she came up with some figure that we get a relatively small amount of revenue, you know, from the estate tax. I'm saying relatively small. It's still substantial, but much less than if you just said, oh, here's how many rich people died and we tax it at a 40% rate. Here's what we get a very small amount relative to that. But she wasn't writing it as a critic of the tax, because the two points she was making, one is exactly this one. The part of the story is we don't want massive amounts of wealth to be handed down. So you get Donald Trump or his kid, you know, walking away with billions and suddenly having all this political influence. But the other is, part of what they do to avoid the tax is do things like start foundations, like the Ford Foundation and the Gates Foundation. Now, those aren't my dreams. I mean, there's a lot of bad things I could say about the way those foundations are run. But the point is, that's not altogether a loss for society, because they do some good things. So to act like, oh, they aren't going to pay the tax, they're just going to start a foundation that provides inoculations to children in Africa, well, that's not a bad thing. So to just look at it and say, okay, how much revenue are we getting from the tax? That is missing the point.
Well, and then, though, going back to Michael Dell, he said, you know, my wife and I set up a foundation and we would have contributed quite a bit more than a 70% tax rate on my annual income. And I feel much more comfortable with our ability as a private donation to allocate those funds than I do giving them to the government.
Well, I guess what I'd have to tell to Michael Dell, he still could do that.
Exactly. But I think what people are saying is, the problem isn't whether that's true in real numbers. The problem is running a society on noblesse oblige, you know, that's...
Yeah, no, we don't want to have to depend on, you know, I wasn't going to go into my criticisms of the Gates Foundation, the others, but yeah, we don't want to depend on their goodwill. I mean, people need health care, they need education, you know, all the other necessities of life, and it shouldn't depend on whether Michael Dell's, he and his wife are good people and they're going to contribute to that. I mean, it's nice if they want to, but that shouldn't be what we depend on.
Well, a poll from that Pinko Rag Business Insider showed that Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, the 70% top marginal tax rate, was more popular than the GOP tax cuts, which you alluded to before. People don't even think that socialism is a curse word anymore, which removes a real arrow from some folks' quiver. But I think we want to say that none of these proposals working on pre-tax income, post-tax income, they're not opponents of one another as proposals, right? And other things like raising the minimum wage could fit in there, too. I guess it just does seem like more ideas are on the table than we've grown accustomed to. And I wonder how we keep that window open and how we keep pushing for more.
Well, it has been great that, you know, you have people put it on the table and there's been a good popular response. And I have to say, to some extent, our best allies in this have been the Republicans, the conservatives, because they've said things that are just so absurd. I mean, I remember Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, was criticizing Ocasio-Cortez's 70% proposal, and he's talking to fifth graders, and he says, so you do some work for your grandmother, and she gives you $10, and the government takes $7 of it, and they all go, that's not fair. Of course, it has nothing to do with her proposal. She's talking about people who get over $10 million, so over $10 million, and so I don't know whether Scott Walker literally doesn't understand a marginal tax rate, or he's just being dishonest about it, but he publicized this, and needless to say, he got raked over the coals for it. My guess is he won't do that again. but it has certainly pushed the window on how we could talk about these things. So in that sense, we don't all have to agree that A, B, or C is the best, or, you know, what I would say is we probably want a mix of A, B, and C. But in any case, it certainly expanded the window of discussion in a really positive way.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker. He is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They're online at CEPR.net. And that's where you can also get hold of Dean's free book called Rigged. His piece, Progressive Taxes Only Go So Far, Pre-Tax Income is the Problem, can be found at truthout.org. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot, Janine. Good to be on again.
That was Dean Baker from February of 2019. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
To pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax preparer. How should I choose one?
Need answers to your tax questions? Go to irs.gov.
Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers. We'll be right back.
and full mega day.
Good afternoon, I'm DJ Firefly. It's time for Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. Starting off this show with Weevil and the tune March On from the release Time Goes. You can see the whole playlist online at WRCT.org.